Pellicle is proudly sponsored by Loughran Brewers Select, a seventh generation family-owned business based near Dundalk in Ireland. In 2014, James Loughran established Loughran Brewing Stores in order to supply high-quality brewing ingredients to the burgeoning beer industries in the UK, Ireland and mainland Europe. The business expanded in 2022 when ingredient wholesaler Brewers Select joined the Loughran family, expanding its suppliers within the brewing ingredient and raw material industry. Some of those suppliers include Crosby Hops, a family-owned hop farm in Oregon, USA, Baird's Malt here in the UK, and industry-leading yeast producer Lallemand. Thanks to their support, we're able to pay more writers, photographers, and illustrators than ever before, and invest in special projects like this podcast. Thanks again to Loughran Brewers Select, who you can find out more about by visiting brewersselect.co.uk/pellicle. And now, let's get on with the show. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Pellicle Podcast with me, Matthew Curtis. Now, it's been a long time since we've done an episode that focuses on cider or perry. And this week, I have an interview for you with a chap called Alistair Morell, who is the founder of an organisation called Cider is Wine. Cider is Wine is part retailer, part distributor, and part trade body. And it lobbies or it campaigns for an elevated view of cider. And the way it frames this is by calling ciders and perries orchard wines. Now, those of you who've been listening to the podcast for long enough can cast their minds back to episode 20, which was published in February 2021. So I recorded it during lockdown. And it was a long, rambling monologue, or a hot take, if you will, where I expressed my thoughts of how cider and perry had failed really to learn from mistakes that beer had made over the past decade in terms of how it presented itself and how it tried to elevate itself. Think about spontaneously fermented beers in 750ml bottles being sold for 25 quid. There was a time where folks like me thought that this was the future of beer and this is how we were going to elevate it. But what we realized is it didn't really need elevating. And there's space for a bit of everything. Here in the UK, and this has become more apparent than ever after the pandemic, after lockdown, what we really want to do is settle in with a nice, delicious pint that doesn't cost us too much. And I think cider is interesting because cider has seen this surge of new producers creating incredible drinks, and there is a place for them in your drinking repertoire, just as there is an expensive bottle of sparkling wine or a delicious lambic or gurs. But what I feel is that cider is, it's very niche, it's very disjointed, and it still hasn't really kicked on. The cider is there. There's some absolutely incredible stuff being made, but you also still have pubs who buy bag-in-box ciders who leave it to get warm and stacked up on the bar top. It's hardly great presentation. It's hardly going to invite someone in to try something. But still, largely, cider in the UK is a mass-produced product made from concentrate. Maybe, actually, the thing is it doesn't need elevating. Maybe those drinks are fine and people who enjoy those drinks should just be left to enjoy them. Although those categories, as we learn in today's interview, are in decline. So what is the future of cider? Towards the end of last year, Alistair joined me in Cafe Beermoth, where he bought a suitcase full of ciders and I brought a bag full of microphones. And previously, we'd had a bit of what I would describe as a tete-a-tete. We had disagreed on where cider is, and I, in particularly, took umbrage with the name Cider is Wine, because for me, cider is cider, and I still feel this. Cider should be allowed to stand on its own two feet, as should perry, and it should be enjoyed at all levels, whether that's a £5 pint or a £20 bottle shared around a table over dinner with friends. There's room for everything. So when I sat down for this interview, I thought we were going to have a bit of an argument and we weren't going to be able to agree on anything. But as is often the case when you meet someone face to face, we realized that we actually had very similar views. Now, terminology aside, the use of language like cider is wine and orchard wines, what we found during this conversation is we had a lot of common ground, and what united our opinion is that we both see the potential that cider and perry has. The potential to find new audiences, the potential to explore new flavors, new markets, and there is still a lot of excitement there. In fact, it instilled back in me something I thought I'd lost. I thought I was losing my desire to invest myself, my thought, in good cider and perry. And this chat reinvigorated me. Now, we have a great chat in this about some of the big topics in cider over the first half an hour or so. And then we actually have a little bit of a tasting and work through some really delicious ciders. So it's a bit of a two-parter with the big topics first and then a chat about some of the most exciting ciders you can buy at the moment. So there's plenty to get into here. What I will also say is that we recorded this in a busy bar. So there's a little bit of background music, some chat, but I've just listened back to it myself and it's not too distracting. So I hope you can still enjoy the interview as much as I did. So without further ado, this is Alistair Morrell of Cider is Wine. Alistair, how are you?
I'm very well indeed. Thank you very much indeed, Matt.
What brings you to Manchester today?
So, spreading the word, really, I suppose, is the best way of describing it. I mean, Cider is Wine is not just a retailer, but actually, in effect, a trade marketing body to advocate for ciders. We call them wines from apples, pears and other fruits, made from 100% juice, not from concentrate, which is a unique standard that we apply for our producer members.
That's interesting, because I didn't know that you were more than just a retailer. So let's talk about how you started Cider is Wine. Why did you decide to start Cider is Wine as a company and organisation?
So I'd come to a career break point, and I was studying for an MBA at Henley Business School, and I was doing some consultancy work just to keep things ticking over. And one of the consultancy gigs that came along was doing some writing for a Swedish cidery, which frankly I've not thought too much about.
Can you say which Swedish cidery?
Yes, Brandland. Okay. from the north of Sweden. And I received some samples from Andreas. He sent them along, and I taste them. With a bit of reluctance, I have to say, it would probably be around about 25 years since I'd actually allowed cider to cross my lips. And these samples were unbelievable. I mean, it would taste that I'd not really found anywhere before. Absolutely sort of dumbfounded me. I was completely surprised. And I said to Andreas afterwards, I said that, you know, they taste great, Andreas. He said, but they're not really wine, are they? He said, well, think about it. What we do is we take the apples, we mill them into juice, we ferment them, we don't brew them, we don't distill them, and we don't add anything, and we put them in a beautiful package for sale. What's the difference between that and wine? He said, apples for sure, but the process is exactly the same as making wine. And that fascinated me and really caused me to dig a lot deeper. And then I realised, obviously I knew that there was an EU law for how you make wine, exclusively from freshly gathered grapes. But of course there is no such law for cider and perry. And every country makes up its own rules. So in Portugal you can make cider from as little as 0% apple juice, whereas you go across the border to Spain, and if you're making cidre, you have to make it from 100% juice and not from concentrate. And of course in this country the law is now 25%, not 35%. It used to be 35% before August the 1st, and all of that can come from concentrate. And yet I was coming across these producers, as I delved more and researched more, that are making like wine. In fact, they felt that they deserved the appreciation as much as any winemaker. And so that crystallized out into a strategy, seeing what was happening in the wine industry and a move towards less but better. What does quality mean? And also drinking less alcohol as well. And that led on to what the profile of these drinks was, which is obviously half the alcohol on average of a bottle of wine, presented like wine, made like wine, harvested but once a year. Why was were these producers not getting any airtime or any opportunity in the market? So Cider Is Wine was born around the standard of 100% juice, not from concentrate. It gives our producer members the opportunity of using the hologram or we license on the label. And it was initially set up as a trade marketing body, solely, just as a B2B operation. We didn't really think too much harder than that. We just thought it would be a fantastic new category to open up and to develop and to, and that was very exciting in terms of taste, in terms of flavour, in terms of authenticity, integrity, and something that would bring innovation to a part of the industry, the wine industry, that is naturally very, very conservative and doesn't embrace new things. And yet, the market is clearly very dynamic, and so this seemed to be something that was a great opportunity to develop.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've just seen cider in the UK, to use a bit of a pun, blossom over the last few years, but it does also feel like it's been difficult to get beyond a very hardcore set of enthusiasts, much like beer has done over the last few years. And I really want to discuss that. But before I do, I want to pick up on something you said, that it was 25 years before cider passed your lips. So what were you doing before cider? And then what was that? Was it the Swedish cider that you just mentioned? That was that the first cider? And is that what gave you the impetus to start what you're doing?
Well, to start with the end of your question first, yes, it was, to put it very simply. And Andreas was a huge support in terms of really just brainstorming the idea of Cider Is Wine. Mm. and the notion of whether it could or couldn't be, and how we, you know, was that an authentic approach to the market or not? It very much has proven to be so. Before I was doing Cider Is Wine, then I've done lots of things in the wine industry. So I left school, started in a new wine warehouse concept in Wigan, believe it or not, moved down to London, and then travelled overseas, did a harvest in Australia with Peter Lehman Wines, one in Vangut Seyfried in Nelson in New Zealand, and pruned a vineyard down the road called Glover's Vineyard, and then came back to the UK and worked for Ogbins around the corner here in Cooper Street, now Salou Wines, I believe. Mm-hmm. And then moved on to Booths supermarkets, was the wines and spirits manager in their new Knutsford store, as it was then, graduated to Bayer, and then was poached to go across the Pennines to Asda, and spent 5.5, I mean, unbelievable years at Asda, which was, as Frank the Fish used to say, you could walk into that head office some days and it was running so hot it was on fire. and that's exactly the way that it was, you know, until it got taken over by Walmart. And shortly after then, I left and jumped the fence and became a poacher turned gamekeeper, and joined a wine supplier, Stratford Wine Agencies, where, for my sins, I discovered Yellowtail, the wine brand.
Oh, so you're responsible.
I'm afraid I am responsible, but I should be. I'm actually very proud of that, because it was a moment in time, as so many discoveries are. It's not because you're any better than anybody else, but it's just happenstance of different events coming together that made it just work and worthwhile. And of course, the States really took over that story a few months later. But I also worked with some great makers, Jean-Claude Mass, who's very much established himself on the UK market, Wakefield, but all wine. And then I went to the, I left there and went to work for the first internet marketed wine brand, Stormhook. And then moved on. We sold millions of bottles of wine to Aldi, created brands for them, created my own wine brand, and then came to a career break, as I said, in about 2016-15. And that cider is wine was born from there.
So why cider? Why have you decided to throw your weight behind this category in particular after so many years in wine?
Well, the UK drinks market is a very complex place, I think that within the wine market, it's fiercely competitive. I mean, every producer and his dog wants to sell in this market. And so it's a place that's really overly full in many respects, and differentiation is really, really hard. So one reason, I'm not saying it's the only reason, but one reason was the fact that this opened up a whole new landscape and opportunity. And I suppose if I reflect on anything over my career, then breaking new ground was something that was a bit of a habit, you know. At Asda was not known for selling wine, and yet we won Supermarket Wine Merchant of the Year award in 1997 with Tim Atkin and Anthony Rose, discovering Yellowtail, putting Jean-Claude Mass on the market, working with Aldi that I did since 2003. You know, these were new areas all the time, and I suppose it was something that really motivated me personally. But then realizing that people really enjoyed these. We got a response at every single turn of our corner. You know, no setting up of any business is easy. You always have lumps and bumps along the way. And at every bump, we've been able to find people who really appreciate this whole new category and whole new landscape of taste. And so that gives you whole encouragement and motivation that says, hey, we're doing something good. We're doing something that's really, really worthwhile.
So I feel I should explain to the listeners how this conversation came about, because a few of you may remember that I did a really long sort of, I call them my monologues, where I talked about how I feel cider has an image problem. And now I come from cider from a beer perspective. I really love cider, but I have often found it difficult to break into. And I see it actually, in the episode I talked about it being fragmented in two, but now I've thought about it, it's kind of in three places. And one is what I would like to call the fine ciders, yourself and what Felix Nash down in London sells, the Ross and Wise, the Little Pomonas, the Olivers, the stuff I really love drinking. And then there is the mass-produced ciders, the Strongbows et al., because that's what dominates the market, the cider from concentrate that most people in the UK, I imagine, would associate with British cider. But then there's also the traditionalists, the bag-in-box ciders, and some of the, you know, the scrumpy West Country cider producers. Roger Wilkins is a wonderful example of someone doing something of rusticity in the cider industry. And actually, for a long time, I saw the fine cider and that side of it as being one and the same, but actually, as a camera member as well, I see huge divides there, more so than I even see in beer, which is quite a divided industry. And I did my rant, and then you reached out, and now a few months later, we're sat here having a conversation about it. So first, mea culpa, because I've been very critical of your name, Cider is Wine, because I think, and I still do feel that cider is cider, but why, I guess, did you choose the name Cider is Wine? Why is that association important to you?
I think it's absolutely critical from almost every angle that you look at. And it really comes down to fundamentally about who you want to serve and who are the customers for this. I come from a wine background, as I've explained, and that goes back 30, 40 years. But let's not forget that wine was considered really something quite different. I mean, really insignificant in comparison to beer and spirits 40 years ago. I remember being in the wine industry and being taunted by my boss, one of which was Justin King, of future Sainsbury's CEO. You know, when's wine going to get bigger than beer? When's it going to be as big as beer? You know, you're just sort of flailing along on the outside. Wine was an awkward industry. It wasn't controlled by four or five suppliers, and it was very fractious. We've seen this industry grow up before, and wine had to reach out way beyond its natural customer base. In the 1960s, wine was drunk by either very posh people with a huge amount of money, or it was drunk by poor people in the sort of hidden away in the back of the bar. And yet wine supplies a third of the alcohol market today. Huge change of not just the market itself, but the perception of wine. We only need to turn on the TV and we see wine being presented in every different aspect of life. It's thoroughly seeped into our psyche. If we're just talking about cider being cider, I'm afraid we've got an industry that is destined for death. And that is very disappointing.
I mean, that's a bit, it's a bold statement. Why do you think that?
Look at the numbers. I mean, very simply, look at the numbers. You know, everyone has access to the Westerns report. 8 out of the top 10 brands of cider are going backwards at a rate of knots. And indeed, one of those brands that's in positive growth has only been introduced by Strongbow to support on a tactical price basis. So, you know, it's just robbing Peter and paying Paul. The COVID decimated cider, and it's not recovered. Why is it not recovered? I speculate that might be about having a huge amount of low quality, high volume product that's on sale that adds no value to our conversation. And if you look at the general trend of alcohol markets as a whole, less but better, is that theme. And that's governed by consumers who, they want alcohol as part of their lives, but they want it only when it's good quality. And we've got to describe what quality means, and we've got to reach out beyond the traditional boundaries of just serving the traditional cider customer. And when you see the opportunity that is afforded to us by a huge amount of these producers making as wine, and the artisanal craft that is winemaking in effect, then it's just a natural thing to reach beyond that. If wine can achieve what wine has done, which it clearly has, why cannot wines from apples, pears and other fruits achieve something similar? It probably is never going to be the same as, but why can't it achieve something similar? I advocate that it absolutely can do. It can do. And, you know, what we're not trying to do here, and it's really important that people understand this, it's not about making cider into wine or wine into cider. It's about advocating that these products deserve our appreciation as much as any fine wine. And we know wine sells for bottles of wine, individual bottles of wine that are fated for a particular reason, sell for thousands and thousands of pounds. Why cannot wines from apples do the same? Again, I propose that they absolutely can, and they can be a point of perpetual and sustained appreciation. And I think that's the really critical point here. We've appreciated wine increasingly as humans for centuries now. We need to start appreciating, not just drinking, these wines from apples, pears and other fruits.
With most of the drinkers in the UK, I imagine they associate cider as a 4-5% draft product or canned product. Do you worry about your approach having a negative effect in gentrifying cider? Do you think, you know, I feel that those those products on the market, maybe not some of the ones, some of the mass-produced from concentrate ones, but there's some fantastic accessible ciders produced by the likes of Ascension and Nightingale in the southeast of England. So how important do you think maintaining that market is that has that perception for that 5% pint of cider? Do you feel that that is something that is still worth investing in with high quality product?
I certainly think any aspect of the sector that involves quality and a set being able to describe that quality to consumers, I think is worthwhile pursuing. I don't think there's any point in having a class debate about gentrifying cider, because I don't think that's what it's about. There's a bottle of whiskey that went on sale for £2.2 million the other day. Does that mean whiskey is now gentrified? I mean, no, I'm sorry, I can't go with that. No, this actually comes back to what is a common thread and theme that is running for consumers about less but better. And it's up to us to describe what better means as those in the industry in language that people can understand, and to present in the best possible way that we can, that people want it in their lives. You know, if you look pretty dreadful, then people are going to believe that it's not that great. You know, we've got to look like we want people's business. We've got to look and meet their aspirations as much as anything else. It was only when Jacob's Creek turned round in the 1990s that wine really started to turn around and say, no, we want to produce what you want to drink. We're not just here to shrug our shoulders and say, well, this is what I've produced, tough luck, which was very much a French attitude. No, this is about coming up to consumer aspirations, about meeting the market, because otherwise there won't be a market if we don't do that. And that would be dreadfully disappointing for this industry that has an enormous heritage in the UK, of something that we should be far more proud of than we actually are. I think it's really, really disappointing to perpetuate something just because, this is the way we've always done it. It's a dynamic industry.
Why do you feel we as drinkers have lost that connection to our cider and perry heritage in the UK? Because, you know, I read the work of Gabe Cook, Adam Wells, and several other writers who really extol the virtues of wonderful cider, but the drinker at large doesn't seem to have that connection any longer. So where and why has that gone?
Well, I mean, I think it's two reasons. First of all, it's about quality. We've lost sight of quality, and I think not just us, but actually the consumer has lost sight of what quality means. You know, if you go and approach a cider on the shelf and you say, well, what does that say to me? 90% of people come away and say, cheap, fizzy, sweet alcohol. And nothing more. I mean, I think that's dreadfully disappointing. No, we have to raise the stakes significantly higher, and people have to have a mark. This comes back to cider is wine, and that's why we authorise our producers to use the hologram or license it on the labels, so that consumers can recognise quality at the point of sale or at the point of consumption. There's no opportunity to do that at this moment in time, and you know, I think that's really poor in a market that is so fast and so dynamic. You know, if you'll know yourself, you go to a supermarket and you're buying orange juice, you have a choice between from concentrate or freshly squeezed. You know that they'll give you a different experience, and you're allowed to choose between them because they're clearly marked, and you pays your money, you takes your choice, so to speak. But there is no appreciation of that. We've lost that appreciation of that quality.
So you're in the supermarket, and the drinks aisle now, you've got bottles of Prosecco, you've got wine from all over the world at a massive array of price points, and you put in some fine ciders and perries in there. So how do you get that customer to engage with those bottles and consider going, oh yeah, maybe I will take a perry home today, maybe I will take a cider home? How do you achieve tapping into the potential of that market, who are already buying wines probably weekly.
Glibly, I might say, look at what we're doing. to be a little bit more detailed about it, then it's about education. It's fundamentally about education, and that's what we are doing. That's our mantra of Cideries Wine: education, education, education. And you know, there's another kind of aspect to why Cideries Wine is about doing what it's doing and calling it Cideries Wine. It's about reaching beyond the boundaries of the traditional cider customer, and that's what the industry is not doing. It's appealing to itself. It's doing what the wine industry did 40 and 50 years ago. It talked to itself very well, but did it talk to consumers? No, it wasn't interested. We talked to ourselves. And the cider industry is doing exactly the same thing. It's talking to itself very well, but it's not talking to those consumers that are beyond its boundaries. And that's what we need to do in order to create a dynamic, sustainable industry that is self-perpetuating, that it's got its own momentum to it. Because right now it's just trading within its own four walls. And that's disappointing.
So just to flip that idea on its head and look at the on-trade instead of the off-trade, we on Pellicle published an article by Adam Wells about the image issue of cider, good cider in the on-trade. There's an image of walking into a pub that advertises cider, but it's bag-in-box cider that's propped on the bar, not cellared, not kept cold, not really given any positive image reinforcement, shall we say. It's not branded or marketed very well. What are the opportunities first in the on-trade if cider was able to change its image? Do you think it needs to change its image?
Absolutely, it needs to change its image. And the idea of selling a cider from a bag-in-box, either behind the bar, whether they're 3, 5 or 20 litres, I think, frankly, is going to struggle to achieve most consumers' aspirations. And look like a rather disappointing serve, and probably be a rather disappointing serve. No, I think we have to up the game several layers. I don't think bag-in-box is a great delivery for hospitality at all. But that's where, you know, I can say Cideries Wine is making a massive difference, because we have product in the Fat Duck already. We have product in other Michelin star restaurants around the country. I just did a tasting with the Balmoral in Edinburgh, one of the two top hotels, I'm told, in Scotland. So at the top end, I can say we're making a very visible and creative difference. But trickle down, and I think we're making a difference in lots of other ways as well. So we've just released our keg initiative, where we're advocating that cider or perry produced in a 20 litre one way keg can be served from a tap and served in carafes and wine glasses, and we've got branded wine glasses with that, which I think is a great opportunity to add to people's repertoire. As house wine moves up in price, why not think about it like this? Serve it in a wine glass, put something to eat on the table. These things I think are great opportunities. Equally, things like Gospel Green, Method Traditionnel, serve it as an alternative to Cava or Champagne. A great alternative. You know, it's not going to offend anyone. It's got a beautiful, sophisticated approach to it. So I think there's lots of opportunities within hospitality to see things differently. Equally, one of my most favourite products is a product that we did as a project last year, What's It Mean to Be Different, which is a still cider aged in Right Bank Bordeaux barrels. Favourite food match would be a sirloin steak with it, because it can handle it, because it's really good. I think on lots of different levels, whether it's as the aperitif, as food matching, or dessert style ice ciders, in hospitality, I think there's a lot of opportunity to develop an approach that is much more aligned with where today's consumers are.
What do you think the opportunities are for Perry specifically? You know, you mentioned Champagne and Carver. There's a big smile on your face there. So Perry, I feel it struggles. It there's a great book coming out next year, I'm sure we're all looking forward to. From we've already mentioned Adam Wells a couple of times, but that'll be out in the spring. But I've spoken to a few producers, and they tell me it's an absolute bastard to make. It's a lot of hard work. It's hard to sell. It's delicious. What do you feel is the opportunity there for Perry in the UK cider market?
This is a hobby horse for me too, and I deeply appreciate Adam's new book coming out. You know, I know that it'll be beautifully written and wonderfully researched to within an inch of its life. Perry, I call the Pinot Noir of this industry, and it's not perhaps the closest analogy, because of course there are many types of Perry pears, but and Pinot Noir is one grape variety. But Pinot Noir is renowned to be a real bugger to produce in the wine industry. It has to be perfectly ripe. It can be pretty poor as well as just totally sensuous and elevate the wine drinking experience to a new level. And that's what I think Perry can do. When it's made well, when it, you know, you're able to capture that perfect ripeness, when you're able to stop it oxidizing too quickly, which of course it has a propensity to do, and when you're able to catch the essence of it, it's a taste sensation that's both light, sophisticated, elegant at one end of the scale, and yet really powerful and assertive at the other. And how do you have these two things going in the same direction, kind of apparently polar opposites, and yet meeting in this beautiful drink called Perry? I think it has the opportunity to stun and to be, you know, quite something quite really uniquely special and something to wax lyrical about.
What's the importance of saying cider and Perry? Because I even then just said Perry is in the cider category, but it's not, is it?
Well, no, but then again, I would argue that cider remains as a product made from concentrate, and should be, you know, we should see wines from apples, pears and other fruits as a completely different segment in their own right, because they're made differently and they're a maker feature of their terroir. I mean, you know, names are just names, but at the end of the day, I suppose they mean something to somebody. But Perry will get its own reputation, I'm sure, and get its own momentum going, because they are sensational drinks and they don't deserve to be lost in the annals of history. They deserve elevating actually to the very highest level.
Coming back to the winification of cider one last time, at least in this conversation, you know, I come from I'm heavily entrenched in beer. I love my cider, but beer is my wheelhouse, so to speak. And I watched over the last decade a lot of new producers, both in the US and the UK and in mainland Europe, focus on producing what we call mixed fermentation beer, a term that doesn't really mean anything to anyone other than a set of nerds like myself. But, you know, wild sour beer bottled in 750s. And a lot of the producers who are still making that almost as a hobby on the side of making lagers and pale ales that keep the lights on in their breweries are saying no one's really buying it anymore. And those beers never managed to break their way into national retail or beyond a few specialist beer bars. And you look at how beer has gone through this evolution, and you know, all these new producers, all these new hop varieties coming from all over the world, and the end result is you've got a handful of brands. Beavertown, now owned by Heineken. Camden Town, now owned by Anheuser-Busch, and they're the brands that have ended up with supermarket listings and the positioning that we thought would be shared between lots of great producers. So how does cider avoid making that mistake? Because the cider producers you promote are very small, they're not doing big volumes. So how do you ensure they manage to get a foothold but don't let that slip to the big guys?
Well, we've got to keep talking about it, but I think if you go back to the core of what the consumers want, look at any food and drink research today, and it'll tell you that consumers want authenticity and integrity from their food and drink experiences. And I think we can see that all around, in every different aspect, whether that be hospitality, but what we're buying off supermarket shelves, what we're buying off independent wine retailers, what we're buying online. People want the real deal, and we've got to keep the quality at the core of it. I think what's gone wrong in the beer industry is, used the beer industry as an example, is that the beer industry has rather done what it's always done. It's focused on volume, and as a result, a number of producers have had to say, well, let's reduce our alcohol levels a little bit, and then we'll get pay a lower duty level. But we've forgotten, we've reduced our personality at the same time in the face of the consumer. And actually, consumers have shown what voted with their feet. We don't, you know, what we want is personality, what we want is interest. And then you get an opportunity to charge for the product. And so what we have to do within the cider industry is continue to focus on authenticity and integrity, and that goes beyond the rather glib sort of response, well, you know, making from concentrate is authentic, and it is, but it's not exactly what people think. If you tell consumers, as I've done many times, you can import concentrate from any country in the world and reconstitute it in this country, and hey ho, you've got a British cider. What? That's bizarre. That's crazy. Or if I say to people, you know, if you make from concentrate in a 75 centilitre bottle, you've got the equivalent of less than one juice of apple in there. Really? Oh, I thought cider was made from apples. You know, it really boils down to something very, very simple. Let's give people what they expect, and let's give people and serve them with something that has got authenticity and integrity, and that's what will sustain us throughout this journey as we go to new horizons of how people drink, how people want to use alcohol. And let's not forget that alcohol has been more long lived in human lives than dairy, and so we should value it, and we should value its part in the social fabric of human life, and I think we should value it very particularly within this scope of from apples, pears and other fruits.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. That's somewhere where cider and beer sort of meet, and there's definitely a mutual appreciation and effort to remind us all that's what it's all about, really. And I think that's a great way of, I'm looking at your bag there, I'm really keen, we've talked a lot about the business of cider, I want to know what's exciting you at the moment.
So this is Gospel Green. This is at one end of the scale. I mean, the producers that we work with...
Cheers.
Santé. Salute. The producers that we work with make everything from dry, the driest of the dry, to the sweetest of the sweet, and everything in between. And so I always start off with something dry as an example. And this is made in exactly the same way as champagne, method traditionnel, says it on the label there. And a methodology, of course, that was invented in this country, which people don't often realise. And again, part of our heritage that we kind of forget, which I think is a great shame. This is made from apples grown in Hampshire, right on the Surrey-Sussex border at the Blackmore Estate, and a wonderful alternative to champagnes, carvers. I love that fizz. I love the sophistication. I love the lightness of it. And we're drinking out of wine glasses here very particularly because, you know, all of the aspects of wine tasting are equally appropriate to tasting these drinks. You know, appearance, nose, particularly important, and of course the palate itself.
I have to say, this is absolutely delicious. I've not tried this before, not to my knowledge. I do notice they use a Y instead of an I for cider, which is something I've always found a bit unusual. I don't know if that's something you have any opinion about. I did when I did that episode. I did go on about how let's stop putting a Y in cider.
Well, of course, it was at some point it did describe a differentiation. As we began to commoditize cider in the sort of 19th century, then cider with a Y described the original product that was made from the 100% juice, and whereas cider with an I was the little cider. It was let down with water, and we started to pay people with it. And so that differentiation did sort of mean something at some point. Of course, we've largely lost that, and to get that going again, I think would be probably quite difficult and arguably quite confusing as well. So I mean, there is reason behind it. How much resonance it has, I'm not so sure with consumers, at any rate.
And so, Gospel Green, where are they based?
They're based in Hampshire, so right on the border of Surrey, Sussex. In fact, if you go to the highest point of their property, you can see the three counties. They're sixth generation apple growers, and pears and cherries, by the way, as well. It's a terrific place to grow apples. This is from Bramleys, Coxes, Russets. You know, utterly delicious, and I think really easy entry point for people.
My first thought when tasting was that I want to open a bottle of that on Christmas morning. That's sort of the it is very champagne like. It's method traditionnel, so it's made in a very similar fashion in terms of how it's, I imagine it's bottle fermented and then
bottle fermented, absolutely.
What's the name of the, when they
disgorge
evacuate, yeah, the yeast, yes. And so it has that lovely moussey carbonation, but also the flavour is of like green apple skins. And some of the champagne I like, it has that green apple skin at the back of the throat, dryness. It's a delight.
I think I've said it already once, but you know, this is not about turning cider into wine or wine into cider. It doesn't have to. We're not saying that this needs to be absolutely like champagne and all of the same soils and all the rest of it. What we're saying is that it deserves our appreciation as much as that champagne. And at 8.4% alcohol, why not open it on Christmas morning and drink it all of the rest of the day as well?
Would you cut it with orange juice and make books?
Well,
there?
People can do as they want with it. You know, it's not for us to dictate how people should drink things. You know, that's really up to people. From my own perspective, it's a shame to cut it down with orange juice, but because it's a wonderfully artisanal product that deserves its appreciation in its own right. But you know, people should do as it.
Indeed, I wouldn't do that either. I was saying that as to be contentious. How much would a bottle of that set you back?
So about £17 on
the
shelf.
That seems very reasonable for something that tastes this good.
But I do want to give you something that is I think that really forges the boundaries, and it is almost like where cider meets wine and wine meets ciders. You know, most consumers today have a repertoire of drinks, and they like to shop horses for courses, and different occasions mean different things. And it's where I don't really think that the boundaries of beers, wines, spirits, ciders are really kind of serving people any longer. They like to mix it up a bit, and this is one of those examples, I think. This is Queen of the Orchard from the English Wine Project, made by a cider and winemaker. Indeed, many of our producers are both cider and winemakers, because the processes are so similar. Made from Spartan and Dabinet apples, aged in Burgundy and Bourbon barrels, and then finished off Col Fondo style, which is a methodology from artisan Proseccos, in actual fact, to introduce the bubbles with this. And that's why it's still dynamic, still got a cloudy appearance, so it's you know, finishing off that fermentation in the bottle. But I get the wonderful sense of mustard and piccalilli and sourness and a smokiness from the barrels. And this is bone dry as well. but what a wonderful drink this is. You know, just I want to reach out for a samosa or a pork pie. You know, I could go either direction with these, or maybe both, perhaps. And great resonance in the palate, and just utterly, really delicious. Something that, you know, was kind of, you know, a brand new taste to me when I first started tasting these, but I think really quite wonderful. And about a tenner on the shelf?
A tenner for this. Mm. I was going to say, wow. So before I even took a sip, I just stuck my nose in there. And you're right, it does have that sort of piccalilli, that acidity. You know, I love pickled, fermented foods, and so I instantly went, wow. And it just has a powerful aroma. The flavour, though, it does straddle sort of white wine and cider. It is bone dry, as you say. I can actually feel it sucking my palate dry.
Yeah.
a few moments after I've taken a sip. But it also has quite a clean sort of minerality to it. You know, it's a delicateness to it that where I would normally expect, I guess, I don't like the word, but I can't find anything else that suits it, that the funk that you get in a naturally produced cider, but that's instead, there's this sort of like clean mineral water kind of like spritziness to it.
Absolutely. And you know, speaking to Kieran about it, the maker, he says, you know, what he really wanted to do here was showcase the apple, the absolute purity of the apple, and give it its real that fruit very much front forward. But and that's, I think that cleanliness is very much that comes across really. And I think that, you know, this is where the approach to winemaking that has been about showcasing the fruit becomes an important factor in how these products are made. Mm. You know, we should showcase the fruit. That's what terroir is all about. That's what provenance is all about.
I get in trouble using that word.
Oh, do you?
Just with beer, but cider is something that can much more easily and simply express the existence of such a thing than beer, because beer is made from lots of ingredients shipped from all over the world, so it's a bit different.
Well, and I think this is very much more about a local approach. And by local, what I mean is local to an individual producer. They can only work with the fruit that they've got, which nature has given them. It's low intervention by its very nature. Fermentation is, after all, a natural process, albeit harnessed by humans. And whereas brewing and distilling are two distinct and different man-made activities that require a heat source. And so, you know, really quite different.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm going to pour you something else now. This is really way out there. It's our most expensive product. I think necessarily so as well, because when you consider that this was harvested in 2014, it's a blend of all those different varieties. It's been brought in from the United States, from Vermont, from, I think, one of the world's most pioneering producers, Eden in Vermont, in Newport, Vermont. And, you know, Eleanor and Albert Leger started this project in 2007. And there were 85 cideries in the USA at that time. Today, I understand that there's well over 1,100. So the growth of cider making in the US is huge.
The colour of this cider, is this what you would call an ice cider?
This is an ice cider made like the ice ciders that originated in Quebec, so frozen naturally cold.
That's incredible.
There's one barrel made of this anywhere in the world. That's, you know, it's very limited quantity. We're lucky enough to have 10 cases of this, so it's very limited in terms of the availability. And just to give you an idea, I've been on the road the last couple of days, in and out of wine stores and wine bars and wholesalers, and I've sold 24 bottles of this in the last 24 hours. So we're not.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, it is absolutely stunning. But in terms of the pinnacle of what cider can produce, then this is it. And it is in our current perspective. You know, wonderful colour. You've got this wonderful sort of rich date, almondy, walnutty nose that's really fills the senses, and then the palate's got this wonderful barrel rancio taste that you get from extended barrel aging. Wonderful length, wonderful acidity, great with Christmas cake, great with mince pies, great with great on its own, just as a meditation. And only 10% alcohol, and yet so fulfilling as a flavour, as a taste.
I would have said that was 15% just on smelling and tasting it. It reminds me of a dessert wine, like a Tokaj or a Sauternes, that sort of thing. It has that. It's girthy. It sort of smothers the palate. But then it's sweet, but not oppressively sweet. That's very special indeed.
Yeah, I think one of the things that characterises a lot of the products and producers that we work with is that they have body, they have texture, and they really convey that, and they convey that with the flavour of the apples from wherever they've been grown, the production methodologies, the vintage that they've been harvested in. All of these things contribute to their wonderful presence. And I come back to the central point. They're deserving of our appreciation as much as the finest things that we know to drink and eat. And in the current perspective, part of that is fine wine, and you could say fine whiskey if you wanted. But that's what they're there to be done, is appreciated and not just drunk.
So this brings me neatly to my last question for you, Alistair, which is, you know, I read a lot about cider and I also publish a lot about cider, and I do find in the UK, the lion's share of attention goes to a handful of producers, and deservedly so. I mean, what Albert's doing at Ross on Wye is, in terms of, you know, you mentioned education, he's really pushing the envelope for me. Little Pomona near there, Tom Oliver has always had a lot of focus. But, you know, you presented me with a range of producers that I've had. You know, there's Templar's Choice Perry here, which we didn't get into as well. You know, how does cider expand out of this bubble and say there's more going on than what might be getting the lion's share of attention?
So we have to collaborate. You know, this is not about me, this is not just about cider is wine, but there has to be a standard around which consumers can gather and understand that quality is associated with that. And that's a really difficult thing to describe, because quality can mean anything. It's a bit like the word craft. What does it mean? Is BrewDog craft any longer? You know,
I'm not going to answer that question.
No, I didn't think you were. But I thought I might tease you a little bit. But we have to describe a quality to people. And it seemed to me that whilst I'm not supportive of everything EU by any stretch of the imagination, and certainly not that wine is only made from grapes, because globally and historically wine's been made from many fruits. But it seems to me that simple standard is a great place to start in explaining to consumers that we have got a really authentic product here that deserves a further look. And we have to reach out collectively, because yes, these producers are small and they don't have huge resources. We have to reach out way beyond our boundaries. You know, this is not just about talking to our mates. It's going well, way beyond that, and being able to express that these are, you know, worthy of another look. And I'm doing that every single day of my working life. And I hope that we can have others join us and help us achieve that too.
I can tell you that after we tasted those three ciders, we went downstairs and the staff of Cafe Beer Moth joined us and we tasted a lot more. And they were really fantastic. And like I said earlier, it really helped reignite my desire to know more and learn more about great cider and perry and how little I do actually know. So thanks again to Alistair for taking the time to chat to me and share those ciders with me and answering some of the bigger questions there. And thank you to Cafe Beer Moth for letting me use their little upstairs mezzanine to record the interview. I hope those of you who've been starved from having a cider or perry related episode feel fulfilled now after that episode, and I hope to be recording more cider episodes in the future. Just a reminder of how you can support Pellicle and this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review of this podcast in your favourite podcast app. It takes a few seconds and it helps other people find the show. But if you're really enjoying this podcast and what we do every week on PellicleMag.com, then please consider subscribing via Patreon for less than the price of a pint a month. And we will use that money to hire writers, artists, photographers to produce more of the content you've been enjoying. And I get to sit down and make more episodes of this podcast. You can do that by visiting patreon.com/PellicleMag. And if you head into your app and read the show notes, you'll find the link there at the bottom. So you can go and do it right now if you really want to. Go on, support your local independent drinks magazine. It just makes sense. That's it from me for this week. Now I have an episode next week. In fact, I have three episodes that will be coming out soon that were recorded at the Indie Man Beer Con, the Independent Manchester Beer Convention last year. I just found out as I was recording this that that may have been the last ever Indie Man Festival. So these episodes are going to be published with a serious poignancy to them, but I'm going to make sure they get out there into the ether anyway. The next one will be on sustainability, and it's a great chat that I hope you enjoy. But until then, thanks for listening. I have been Matthew Curtis, and you have been listening to the Pellicle Podcast. Bye-bye for now.